to be in orbit.
Happy holidays, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. We're doing something a little bit different. We're just running up to the holidays, so we thought everyone's busy for interviews and things like that, so we thought we'd just review, essentially, what we've been doing up till now. A little bit of housekeeping first. We actually have our first upcoming live show on the 29th of December at 4 p.m. EST. We'll be having a few guests reviewing the year, and hopefully, you know, you'll get some surprises and you'll have a good time. So if you're going to join us for that, make sure you grab your favorite beer and hop on and enjoy just a casual chat with us. We plan to take a short break in January, so we'll call this season one up until now, and we plan to return probably towards the end of January after a little bit of a break. We'll be recording interviews all throughout, and we've got some great guests, so I hope you guys are excited. Before kicking off, I just want to thank every single one of you who listens, supports, comments, and especially sends us fan art. I've been loving the fan art. I'm bowled over by the response, and I know Roz is as well. You guys gave us such a warm welcome, and we couldn't be happier to be finding our tribe and our people, you know? But without further ado, let's get on to the highlights. So we started off the show with an interview with Richard Hatem. He is the screenwriter for the Mothman Prophecies movie. He also has his own podcast called Richard Hatem's Paranormal Bookshelf, which I highly, highly, highly recommend. It's one of my favorites. When Richard joined me, we spoke about all sorts of things, from writing the Mothman Prophecies to John Keel actually being a pretty funny guy and clearing up something I wanted to know on a personal level, that I found a note to Dan on the back of the original Mothman Prophecies manuscript in the Mothman Museum in Point Pleasant, and it said, "Dan, the secret of the universe is on page, I think it was 60 something." But anyway, I know that's a joke now, and he's just a wind up. There was no page that, and me getting out of the cage would have been, or out of the case, would have been a terrible thing to do in the museum. And I'll stop emailing them and asking them to check that page for me. Richard also spoke about some real practical advice for getting into the world of screenwriting, and how to nurture your creativity. As a creative, I loved that. His analogy was about how you kind of identify the muse as a sneaky fox, and you create a situation where that fox is willing to come out of the woods to you and, you know, feed your projects, whatever they may be. It was a really beautiful analogy, and I highly recommend you go listen to Richard say it instead of my butchered version. I just want to give a shout out to X Does It All over on YouTube, one of our very, very early champions and the very first comment on this interview, actually. So thank you so much for sticking with us, for listening, and just your positivity. It means the world. My chosen clip for Richard is where he talks about time stuff, he calls it. He says time stuff is the scariest stuff, and it's all about predetermination and whether we have control or free will. It's a really interesting comment, and it got a lot of conversation kind of going around it. I'll stop talking. Here's the clip with Richard. So Keel's work, it returns to the idea of things come in through time, maybe. And he explains it. I'd recommend people go read his books. But there's one phrase that keeps coming up when he talks to experiences, which is they say they were asked, what is your time cycle, by the beings kind of coming from, wherever they're coming from. So what is your time cycle? What do you think that means? Like when you read Keel, what does that set off in your head?
The time stuff is the scariest stuff. That to me is scarier than Bigfoot or ghosts. This notion that we don't understand time, and that time does not necessarily, or we have a limited understanding. Because the minute you start talking about time anomalies, precognition, precognitive dreams, things like that, it immediately almost becomes physically repellent because it contradicts our notion of free will. If a person is able to have an accurate dream or prediction of a future event that does come to pass, where does our free will work in that? And then, because it's implying that, oh, everything is sort of predetermined, and so now it's just a matter of getting a glimpse at what's coming next on the next page. And if everything's been predetermined, who is it being predetermined by? And all of these things really mess with certainly my, you know, notions of autonomy, free will, or even sort of, you know, human, you know, supremacy upon the earth. It's like, maybe we're not. And of course, when people talk about their experiences with aliens, visitors, extraterrestrials, whatever you want to call them, it certainly does imply that there are intelligences far above us that sometimes make their presence known. And very few people come away from those experiences feeling great. You know, they use phrases like, you know, that thing looked at me like I was food. Or, you know, it looked upon me as we look upon insects, as something so far below it as to be inconsequential. And that, you know, I mean, look, everyone knows I've got an ego, but we all do to a certain extent. We all almost need that to go through our lives and operate successfully and have a job and conduct relationships. If you spend too much time thinking about the fact that maybe we are cattle to another race of beings, that's not going to make your weekend go really great.
Next up, I was honored to invite Maya Cowan onto the show, cultural anthropologist, PhD candidate, and a graduate instructor. She shared her family's history with paranormal experiences, and even all the way up to teaching one of the very first university courses on unidentified anomalous phenomena, which is kind of a big step, right? Maya makes the very important point that UFOs were seen long, long, long before the modern day. We always talk about in the community, we kind of have this slant towards, you know, Western male experiences. But that's not the only people that experience it. You know, women have experiences. It's not just in the West, it's worldwide. And it's in history. So Maya brought a really good voice to indigenous people's experiences of UFOs and how they pass that knowledge down through verbal histories. Maya also spoke about decoding languages, which is really important when it comes to the kind of UFO alien conversation. The first thing we're going to have to do when we meet something that isn't us is talk or communicate. So decoding languages is a really important part of this conversation. We had a lovely email, probably one of my favorites since starting this, from a listener about this episode. They enjoyed that episode on Indigenous Peoples Day. We didn't release it on Indigenous Peoples Day on purpose. It was a complete synchronicity, and it was wonderful because these particular listeners listened to it with their children, and it prompted conversation about Indigenous peoples, how they're treated, their place in the world today, their history, the history of America. And so that's just amazing to, you know, when we started this, I would have been happy with one person listening and getting a kick out of it. And here we are going multi-generational through a single family and, you know, providing a base for a really great, rich, serious conversation. So I love that. Thank you for sending that in. I won't say the name here because it came through email, but it meant a lot. So thank you. My chosen clip from this interview is about settler colonialism and kind of the ethics of space travel. People don't really think about this stuff, but obviously when we're going out into the universe, we kind of have to think about how we affect other planets. Can we carry microbes? Can we, you know, essentially infect another planet by accident with some disease from Earth, or, you know, just ruin the environment there? And on top of that, you know, people can barely coexist on Earth together. And so going out into space where the conditions, quite frankly, just want to kill you every second, and you've got this, you know, thin metal tube around you, it puts people on edge. And so we kind of have to think about ethics of space travel in terms of how we treat each other, how we treat, you know, different countries when they're in space, and how we treat something else if we encounter it there as well. So without further ado, here's the highlight from Maya. I saw that you wrote, I was looking at the course, you know, that you're doing with the Coalition for UAP Studies, and I saw that you'd written that UAP and space exploration sometimes mirrors the ideals of settler colonialism. Would you mind elaborating on that a little bit?
Yeah. So there's actually a really great issue of, I think it's the Journal of American Indian Studies or something like that. I would have to double check, but it certainly would be on the syllabus for that course that you'd be able to find that. And I think that this particular issue is open source as well, if people are interested in reading more about it. But there was a project through, I think it was just the SETI Institute a while back, where they sort of convened a group of indigenous scholars from North America and asked them to basically write a statement on the ethics of space exploration from an indigenous perspective, and indigenous studies perspective. And, you know, in this original statement that they wrote, they were quite critical of it and said that it needs to be approached in such a way that, you know, we're not just looking at space exploration as, like, quote unquote, the final frontier. We're not just looking at it from the perspective of what we can potentially exploit from other cultures and other planets that we could think about visiting that would be potentially inhabited by life. And so, yeah, so they were quite critical in their original statement. There's also some politics around things, like one of the articles talked about, I believe it was an observatory that was built, like a telescope that was built in Hawaii, that was built on indigenous land without permission. And how, you know, there are sort of all of these pitfalls along the way of thinking about this sort of human future of answering the question, are we alone? And not only are we alone, but how could we potentially get to contacting these other cultures, these other planets, these other beings, supposing that we're not alone? And what should that look like, so that we're not doing it in a way that is mirroring the real horrors of the colonial project?
Absolutely. It's definitely worth us all kind of remembering that everyone's an alien somewhere, right? And when we go to these other planets and we go to these other cultures, even on our own planet, that we should tread kindly and carefully and not just exploit
there.
Following Maya, I invited on Dr. Michelle Fournay. She is a marine ecologist and acoustic researcher, essentially, you know, my second serious interview. And Michelle took us, or should I say Dr. Fournay, took us into the mysterious world of whale communication. And she reflected on what whales, an intelligent non-human species that communicate through intricate song, might teach us about connection, cooperation, and how we might one day speak to a non-human intelligence after first contact. It was a very rich conversation. We even spoke about how marine life rebounded during COVID and how we should probably be leaning into the unintended benefits that came from that. Another thing that I feel kind of, you know, passed by like ships in the night was that interview actually contained a question from Luis Elizondo. He asked Dr. Fournay about establishing a baseline for nonverbal cues. Now, my partner and lovely wife, Elena, calls this loose clues, where he doesn't outright say something, but he'll like hint at it. And here we have Lou essentially saying like, hey, you know, we have to think about nonverbal cues. So to me, I take from that, hey, these visitors might not speak like us. They might not have language like us. So how do we interact with something that only speaks in kind of physical cues, right? We had some really great feedback emails from you guys for this one. People were really moved by it. I hope it makes you all look at every life form like there's a little more going on inside than we thought. And maybe you've even had some funny conversations with your pets. Do let me know. But my chosen clip from the interview with Michelle is where she explains the whoop kind of sound. In the interview, I point out I have a tattoo of that sound from the movie Fathom. You can see it right here. And that is essentially something that every whale calls out. And it's slightly different between each whale. So they think they're calling their names into the darkness. And when I think about that, I just think about life for everyone in general, right? We're not particularly defined until we start interacting with others and they kind of say, oh, here I am too. And then your character emerges as you interact. Very, very similar to humans, and whales are just, you know, the oldest culture on Earth, arguably. I mean, you know, Michelle says that. I assume she knows more than me. So she definitely does. So yeah, without further ado, I'd love to show you this clip. Bear in mind, these whales are shouting, I am, essentially. And for those of you out there with a keen ear, I'm sure you're responding with, I am that I am. And I think that's intentional. So let's talk about some of these sounds. So in the film, we identified there was the teepee, the droplet, the growl, quite a lot of calls, but there was one kind of magical one called a whoop call. that seemed to be the key. Can you tell me about that and why all humpback whales make it?
Yeah. This call, I think, is one of the most important sounds that humpback whales worldwide produce. So it's a really lovely call. It sounds like is sort of how I impersonate it. And we've done some research, again, sort of laying the foundation for understanding all these things. And in every population that we have looked for this call, we have found it. So I've listened to recordings from Antarctica and heard whoop calls. I've listened to recordings from South Africa and heard whoop calls, from Hawaii, from Rarotonga, from Iceland, from Norway, from California, from Alaska. Every place where we have looked for it, we have found it. And this call is produced by male whales, by female whales, by young whales, by old whales. And there are several calls that we think are ubiquitous like this that might be innate, you know, calls that are sort of embedded in the humpback whale repertoire. But this one really dominates in that it's very commonly used. And when I, you know, I've listened to hundreds, probably thousands of hours of humpback whale, you know, acoustic exchanges. And one of the things that myself and my colleague, Chris Gabriel, and her colleague, Lauren Wild, sort of noticed just by listening is that this call occurs in these counter calls, that you hear one, and a few moments you hear another one, and they're slightly different. And so we developed this hypothesis that this is a contact call. This is a way that a whale would find and identify another whale.
So, like yelling Marco Polo.
Yeah, a little bit like Marco Polo, a little bit, exactly. And the other thing that we're working on now, and I'm actually headed to Alaska in just a few weeks to dive into this, is this concept of voice. Is, can you tell the individual by the sound of their voice? And if so, is this the right call to find it? If all whales are producing this call and whales use this to counter call back and forth with one another, if there is embedded this concept of voice, it means that whales might be using this call to identify one another. And what we know, and there's actually some new research that just came out that demonstrates that humpback whales in Alaska, I mean, they form relationships that last for decades. And different whales spend time in sort of in different communities. And how do they find each other? If you're going to maintain a relationship underwater where light travels a very short distance and sound travels very, very far, it makes sense that if you're trying to find someone that you know, that you'll do so through sound. And so I think that this whoop call is the whale's way of maintaining contact with one another. And it also just shows up everywhere when you listen. And it's a wonderful sound to hear. And so it made sense when we're trying to understand this system of communication to start there, to start with the foundational. You know, you said earlier in this conversation that part of what science does is to recognize the unusual, you know, to find the weird. And so much of science and a lot of society is about identifying the rare and the precious. And I do the opposite of that. I want to understand the most mundane humpback whale behavior there is. I want to know what these whales do every single day without even giving it a second thought. I am much less interested in the anomalous, and I want to be able to perceive the world from the perspective of these animals, which means understanding their ordinary behavior.
After Dr. Forney, I got to have a conversation with Sarah Gamm. She is an ex-unidentified anomalous phenomena task force analyst for the DOD. She also works at other places, kind of in the government, doing signals analysis, which makes her very well suited to analyzing the data from potential UAP. She took us from her roots as a fourth generation Missouri farmer to unraveling all the mysteries of UAP in the intelligence community. She cleared up a lot in this interview. She addressed the furor around the jellyfish video that Jeremy Corbell brought out and the assessment that the UAP task force had that it was prosaic. And it turns out the interviewer where this kind of happened actually, you know, mixed two videos up and it wasn't clear. And so her answer wasn't super clear. She also cleared up her actual role with the task force because some people in the community have been bad-mouthing her, sadly. She does speak about that. And it's kind of emotional when she does. You know, you can see that it's affected her deeply. I really love the part where Sarah talked about her anxiety in coming out in James Fox's The Program, which is the first time she spoke about the work she did with UAP. That particular clip in the movie sat with me because you can just see it on her face that she's almost taking a run up to say, yes, I worked on UFOs for the US government and we are not alone. Sarah also shared with us, and this was new to me, having watched all of her other interviews, an encounter with a blue being in her bedroom, which was startling. Highly recommend you go watch that. She also explained the difference between psychics and mediums, how to protect yourself when doing that kind of work, and also how to find peace in this chaos. This episode also had a kind of emergence of one of our superfans, Cyan Kassar from Malta. Cyan has been such a big supporter of everything I've done, and he comes out swinging, you know, with positivity. He commented on this one, everyone and everything is connected. Cyan, I couldn't agree more. He's first on every video's comment pretty much, and quite frankly, I owe him a drink. But the highlight of this interview for me was Sarah's reaction when I showed her a video from Ocean X, where an oceanographer was talking about meeting aquatic life down in the ocean, and he describes them, and it makes me think of the abyss and the creatures from the abyss. And yeah, you get to see Sarah's response live when I show her that. So enjoy the response. I'm gonna show you a video now. We're gonna go from something serious to something fun. It's not a UFO video. I'm not gonna show you a UFO video and then ask your opinion. It's something that someone from Ocean X said many, many years ago. And this video, whenever I find it online, it disappears and I can never find it again, so I saved it, and I just have it kicking around to look at every now and then and kind of go, whoa. So I just wanted to show you and just get your thoughts on whether there was any crossover with the kind of USO kind of subject, you know, the unidentified submergible object.
I think in the ocean, I have come across potentially beings from another heavenly body that are more highly advanced than humans. My name is Lou Lamar. I'm an underwater director of photography for National Geographic and for Ocean X. I've seen giant deep sea arachnids, venomous sea snakes far offshore with like bright yellow heads, deep ocean volcanoes, technicolor deep ocean chemosynthetic worms, you know, sharks in a frenzy, orcas swarming all around me, some sort of, you know, hyper advanced aquatic alien creatures inhabiting the shallow waters, which almost look like stingrays. It's always the most beautiful place for me to be in, this three-dimensional void of space and quiet. Probably should be scared of, you know, giant pissed off whales headed right my way with their jaws open, but for some reason my heart rate just stays low and I just stay calm and keep cruising.
Okay, so not only does that guy have probably what is one of the coolest jobs in the world by working how he's saying he spends his day, but he says some really provocative things there. What did you think?
My first thought is, so what we haven't talked about is I'm also a psychic medium. So some of my experiences through my meditations and my mediumship and some of my healing sessions of clients, some of that resonated with me there. With my science hat, so of course, two different hats, even though the worlds are married and they're one. I have definitely seen I'm trying to think of how to phrase it and how I've likely phrased it before, just making sure I won't have work issues. Objects going in and out of water. So yes, from both hats of mine, from a spiritual aspect and then a scientific aspect, some of that resonated.
Next up, we had Geraldine Sutton Sith. Geraldine was an amazing find. I actually met her a few years back when my wife and I were traveling across the USA, and I came across the Etsy store where she sells these little things. This is a goblin on a shelf. She actually sent me this one after the interview as a thank you, which was super kind of her. Thank you, Geraldine, if you are listening. So Geraldine is the daughter of the lead witness, Elmer Lucky Sutton, of the Kelly Hopkinsville goblin encounter. And in this interview, Geraldine walks us through the full encounter, the UFO seen dropping into a gully, the little man at windows that her, you know, grandma described as goblins, the gunfire, the panic, the police involvement, the what she called the invasion of the people, i.e. the people coming afterwards, and they were just taking things from the house. It was insane. Really quite harrowing just on that level without the alien stuff. But she also shared new details. I'm really interested in this case, and I'm surprised that I didn't know these before, but it's very cool, and it just goes to show there's always something to learn. She shared some details about a glowing liquid that you could only kind of see glow when you were far away from it. That was found by the police and supposedly came from one of the creatures being shot. She also shared some new evidence referring to a ship retrieval, a crash retrieval. So this is a bigger story than it initially appeared. And new details are kind of still being found about it now. And Geraldine makes that point, you know, that they thought they had this nailed down way back when, but they're just finding so much stuff, missing witness reports, you know, proof that police weren't filing the reports they were taking from this family. We had a wonderful comment from Courtney9358 over on YouTube, who said, "This story has always fascinated me, but at the same time, I'm fascinated by it. I'm so glad you had Geraldine on and tell some new information I had never heard before." I couldn't agree more, Courtney. And yeah, amazing to have her on. I'll have her back on in the future as well to share any new details and things like that. But just so you all know, right after the interview, I actually put Geraldine in touch with David Mahler, who runs the National UFO Archive in the USA. So he has a lot of clippings and original evidence and investigation things in the archive that Geraldine hasn't seen. And Geraldine has a lot of stuff that he hasn't seen as well. The highlight from this one for me was where Geraldine shared an amazing new piece of info she found where her dad, Lucky, said that you couldn't see the goblins in the light. The implications from this are mind-boggling. So when you pointed a torch at the goblins, they were invisible. But when you put the torch away, you could see their silhouette, which is really strange. But anyway, go listen to Geraldine tell it, and then come back and email me your ideas about it. Are there any implications from the fact for you? I'd be really, really curious to hear.
So here you got this caravan of cars going out to little Kelly in the middle of the night. About 25 people in all. So here they are pulling up in the driveway, everywhere they can be. And they get out, and it feels funny. It's eerie feeling. Something has certainly went on here. There were shotgun and rifle shells all over the ground outside, shotgun and rifle shells all over the inside of the house. The woodwork and the screens were shot. Clearly, something happened here, but what? They searched. They couldn't find any bodies. They couldn't find any blood. They did see, well, one of the police officers' cars did see a puddle of glowing substance by the post where they had shot that one at. So the first thing they did was get out and run to check that out because it was glowing. And when they got to it, it wouldn't glow. The only time it would glow is if you would walk away from it from a distance, you could see the glow. They called the chief over there, and Chief Greenwell came over there and looked at it. And sure enough, he could tell a difference. When you looked straight at it, there was like a spot on the ground that was different from the area around it. So what was it? Don't know. So anyway, they searched and searched, couldn't find anything. Finally, the chief went to my grandmother and told her, listen, Miss Glennie, I'm so sorry, but there's nothing we could do. There's nothing here. You know, no blood, no bodies, no limbs, no feathers, no fur, nothing to show that you did shoot anything. So they left.
Our final interview of the season was the great and legendary Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist and ufologist, probably the ufologist, or at least one of, right? Friedman spent his life challenging the narrative surrounding UFO sightings and government secrecy. He made the point that UFOs are real and they should be studied by science. Bottom line, this particular interview was from 2016. Roz filmed it herself at a UFO expo in Canada. And there are a few more interviews to come from this as well. We have quite a cool little batch that Roz kept. And yeah, we're very, very lucky to have them, especially someone like Stanton Friedman. I'd love to talk to him for real, but unfortunately, he did pass away in 2019. Rest in peace, Stanton. In the interview, Stanton spoke about what we should keep in mind when studying UFOs. He also spoke about how recent advances in science help us. And I find that really interesting because when I think of someone like Carl Sagan in the 80s saying that alien life doesn't exist, he literally had no idea exoplanets exist. Now we have instruments up there and a website I can go check right now, and it tells me there are 5,000 plus exoplanets, and a small percentage of those are in the Goldilocks zone that supports life as we know it. And I think we have to remember that. You're speaking within the confines of the knowledge that's been created around you. David Pierce, who actually joined us for his Contact episode titled It Follows, episode 13, highly recommend you go listen to it because David tells his story so, so well and you really get an idea of the impact on people. But he commented on this. He said, Stanton was a true gent and a pioneer in the field. Great video. And David, I couldn't agree more. He was an absolute pioneer. And people look over his work these days for, you know, the work of people like George Knapp, Jeremy Corbell, various other people, outlets, channels that kind of cover this stuff. But they don't go back and kind of see what Stanton had to say, and they should, because he knew his stuff. You know, he's a nuclear physicist. If we want to talk about the nuclear connection with UFOs, if we want to talk about the nuclear propulsion system that Bob Lazar kind of says, you know, exists in these UFOs, then we have to listen to people like Stanton, a nuclear physicist who was happily a ufologist and would just bring gravitas and logic and detail to the discussion. My highlight from this interview is the bit right at the end where Stanton talks about how positive first contact could be. He mentions that, sure, we're kind of, you know, humans like war and, you know, there's a lot of violence here, but that doesn't mean that any visitors are going to be that way. All of our social constructs, you know, even arguing over the definitions of male and female, might not even exist on another planet. Please enjoy this clip from Stanton Friedman.
You know, I'd like to see the time come when the government says, well, yeah, we've been lying for 70-some years. And here are the reasons. You know, I suppose there would be some kind of explanation. And the thing that bugs me a little bit, this year, the military budget will be $1 trillion. On planet Earth. And lots of kids died of starvation yesterday and the day before that. We need to, I think, realign our thinking on planet Earth. Because the weapons get better, meaning they can cause more destruction. That's not a good thing. So I'm concerned about the future of my great-grandson. I have one, he's 8 years old. What kind of world is he gonna grow up? I don't think it's appropriate for us Earthlings to spend $1 trillion on things military in a year. We need clean water, clean air, enough food to feed our kids. So I have these larger concerns, and I hope that sometime in the near future, while I'm still alive, that things will get better. We'll have a different recognition of where we fit and where our priorities ought to be and stuff like that. And remember, there's a lesson here. Aliens have been observed for a long time. They haven't destroyed us yet, have they? That's a good sign. Somebody maybe got through the stage of too much technology and not enough sociology. So I'm an optimist because of that. They don't come down and splatter the people all over the place or the buildings. We do that, but the aliens don't seem to. So that makes me optimistic. There is hope for mankind, in other words.
Thank you for listening to this highlights episode with me. Before I let you go, I just want to point out a common thread between all of our guests. Every single guest has spoken about compassion, about how we should be decent to the people we meet. Look for small ways that we can help someone's day be better, to make it lighter. Because when we're having a bad day, don't we all just want that little bright spark in the day that's going to turn it around? I know I've had small acts of kindness done for me that have turned a bad day into an incredible day. Take a shot. Do something nice for someone. And I know you're all buying gifts and stuff for people at Christmas, but you know, maybe go to that homeless guy at the end of the street and buy him a coffee and a warm meal. Get him a new pillow or a sleeping bag. You know, these things aren't that expensive and the impact they have is immeasurable. You never know how that's going to come back around for you as well. The universe tends to reward kindness. And with that, that brings us to the end of the show. I hope you've enjoyed kind of reviewing the first few months of the podcast. I want to say 3, maybe 4. I've thoroughly enjoyed making it. I know Ross has too. We're very proud of what we've done so far, and we're looking forward to getting bigger and better as we go on. We're really excited to take this podcast to new places in 2026 and hopefully have some in-person interviews for the first time with some very exciting guests that we've got lined up. So I hope you have a wonderful holidays. I hope you have a wonderful new year, and I wish you all the luck and love in the universe, but save a little for me if you wouldn't mind. But if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Spotify or on your chosen platform. If you could like, share, or subscribe, that'd be very much appreciated as it helps kind of find our people. In fact, that would be a good Christmas gift for me. Send this or any of the shows to one person you think might like them. And thank you for that Christmas gift if you do choose to do that. If you'd like to support the show and get access to a 1-hour live chat each month and early ad-free access, you can find us at Patreon. Just follow the link in the show notes or at our website, www.tobehumanshow.com. And most of all, feel free to reach out via the contact page or email us at hello@tobehumanshow.com. You can also find us on Blue Sky, Threads, Instagram, or X at To Be Human Show. And as always, remember to be curious, because the universe is bigger than we know.
What It Means to Be Human is a Double Barrel production. This week's episode was produced by Roz Mugford and Dan Zetterstrom. Sound post-production by Parker Mosley, with technical support from Dale Mugford. Our theme music is by Thunderbird.